Сегодня, основываясь на результатах референдума,
в России
12 марта 2014 года.
Очередной черный вторник, на этот раз 16 декабря 2014.
Черный вторник для российской экономики.
Российская валюта опустилась до новых минимумов на
московской бирже. А ведь Владимир Путин обещал в начале ноября, что колебания рубля...
In many ways, the Russia story over the past year can be summed up as a tale of two Tuesdays, 9 months apart. On Tuesday, March 18th, there was Vladimir Putin's rousing, swaggering, chest-thumping speech to the nation announcing the annexation of Crimea and heralding Moscow's new dreams of empire. That was the day that Russia challenged the world order. And then the bill came due. On December 16th, there was Black Tuesday, when the ruble crashed and the economy swooned under the weight of falling oil prices and Western sanctions. That was the day the world order bit back. The Kremlin, no doubt, is feeling the heat. But how will it react? We're back. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark, and Happy New Year.
And a Happy New Year and indeed Orthodox Christmas to you too.
Thank you. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean, and Happy New Year to you as well.
Happy New Year to both of you.
Well, Russia's been quiet this week. As Mark noted, the nation observes the Orthodox Christmas holidays. But it's an uneasy calm, one thick with anticipation and apprehension. Western leaders are clearly hoping that the shock to the Russian economy that we're experiencing now will lead to a change of course in Moscow. Latvia, the current holder of the EU presidency, says it sees an opportunity for Russia to agree to a negotiated settlement of the Ukraine crisis. Others aren't so sure. Leonid Bershitsky, the self-exiled journalist, argued in a recent article in Bloomberg that Putin's regime is on the verge of transforming from a mild authoritarianism to an outright dictatorship. Mark, you tackled this issue, some aspects of this issue, in an interview you gave to Vox this past week. How do you see the escalating economic crisis affecting the Kremlin's behavior, both in terms of the Ukraine crisis and in terms of Russian domestic politics?
Yeah, I mean, that Vox interview did rather strip out much of the nuance of what I'd said. I think really what we're talking about is a pressure on the system that really does sort of strike at the very heart of what it's about, which is, in other words, as you've raised, often there's this social contract that's struck between Putin and the masses as well as Putin and the elite. But the issue is, I'm unconvinced that in a way that we're seeing anything as clearly identifiable as a policy. I mean, I was in Moscow over the Christmas period, and it was interesting because there were two different strands of opinion that I was hearing. One was these rather feverish rumors that in February there was going to be some attempt to unseat Putin from within the Kremlin, which I don't actually buy for a moment.
No,
I think, yes, Putin is going to fall to an elite putsch, but I think we're at least a year away from that. Things have got to get a lot worse. There'll be a lot more behind-the-scenes conversations. But nonetheless, I think what that represents was not actually a sort of a serious belief, but a sort of a desperate hope that somehow a deus ex machina was going to intervene
what,
soon.
What quarters are you hearing these conspiracy theories from?
I mean, these are sort of the Western-looking intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the people who basically would want Putin to fall anyway.
The usual
and
suspects, that, the people that talk
yeah,
to us.
And precisely, and it's that kind of, you know, this is their Christmas wish. They're hoping Santa's going to bring them a coup. But then you have a second strand of opinion that I was hearing, and it was much more from people who are actually sort of on the economics side of things, who are saying, look, nothing's happening. And when they say that, they don't just simply mean that there's not going to be any grand developments, but also a distinct lack of policy, a distinct lack of strategy. And that, for them, was the big problem, that there just didn't seem to be any real policy or plan. So you might say, on the one hand, you have the people who want to see dramatic change, hoping it's going to somehow be done by other people. And the people who want to see, shall we say, more kind of incremental reform, seeing that it's not being done by anyone. So I think we're at the moment, we're in a moment of kind of crisis and drift.
Is anybody happy with the status quo? Maybe a dumb question.
Well, I suppose they're probably not the kind of people who chat to me anyway. I mean, probably not. I mean, there's a lot of people who are still living very well. But even they, I'm sure, would rather the situation could be sort of rewound 12 months.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sean, what do you think? How do you see this economic crisis affecting Russia's behavior, both internationally and domestically? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think, as a lot of Western leaders are hoping, this is going to lead to a change of course? Or do you agree with Brzezinski that this is going to lead to a renewed crackdown and a harder line from the Kremlin?
I think it's really hard to say because, as Mark pointed out, there seems to be a lot of inaction and in some major policy way to deal with what's coming forward in the economy for 2015. And it's really hard to predict how the Kremlin will react to these pressures. I tend more on, I'm probably closer to Brzezinski and thinking that the Kremlin might see this, as it's been saying for months now, that this is an attack from outside. This is part of a conspiracy to bring Russia down. And it might, you know, harden itself and harden the population, as Putin said during his press conference, that we're going to go through tough times and we need to hunker down and pull ourselves kind of through. But my concern while doing that is that the Kremlin does need to take some sort of action to deal with the problem that it has, especially on the economy. I have a feeling on the Ukraine issue, I think things will just kind of stumble forward and there'll be these signals as we've been seeing, but I wonder if anything will really come to fruition and the crisis will just kind of linger on.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, we talk about this lack of policy on the economy. I'm not sure what they can do right now on the economy. Because let's face it, the economy is being driven by the falling. I mean, the economic crisis is the primary driver of that. Is the falling oil price. And we've all been saying for how many years that Russia's always going to be in this dangerous situation until it diversifies its economy. As long as it's dependent on commodities prices, when this happens, it's going to happen. The oil price is being driven down by a lot of factors. Declining demand in China, declining demand in Europe, the increased production in the U.S., the shale coming on the market. There's a lot of things drive the Saudi decision not to cut production. There's a lot of things driving the oil price. And the oil analysts say the long-term trend is down. But the time for Russia to do something about this inevitable eventuality was years ago, not now. There's not very much they can do right now. I think they're kind of stuck with the situation, no?
Yeah, they are, but there's also an element of perception that I think is important, particularly for the government to project out to the population, that it's at least trying to do something, that it's doing as best they can, that this is the policy going forward to kind of placate and settle down any fears of deep economic recession. I mean, populations can withstand a lot. And the most important thing for a government to do is maintain its legitimacy in times of crisis. So they may not be able to do anything really to deal with the crisis, but they have to at least give the perception that they're doing something.
Now, there were rumors towards the end of last year, Kirill Kobrin brought them up last time he was on the podcast, about that, you know, maybe we're going to see this Putin try to reinvent himself in a liberal direction, bring Kudrin in as prime minister. There's all these, you know, this dream that just won't die in some quarters of elite liberals. And I keep asking myself the question, can this Putin reinvent himself again, or is this it? You know, and we've brought this up. Mark, you said it's, you know, he's going to fall to an elite coup eventually. Can he reinvent himself? Can Putin have a coup in within Putin, or can we see a new Putin?
Well, ever? I mean, theoretically, one should never sort of damn anyone and say they have no chance of redemption. But I mean, I would turn, you know, ultimately, sort of rather than being a hack, try and be an actual scholar for a moment and say, well, where is the empirical data? I mean, I think, you know, do we have any evidence that Putin is at all interested? Any evidence that Putin believes there is a need to reinvent himself? And the answer is I can see absolutely nothing. This is entirely because we cannot see inside that little black box of Putin and his closest advisers. In a way, if I can mix my metaphors, it becomes a Rorschach inkblot test. You know, that all of us kind of project onto it. I mean, for what it's worth, for example, I don't actually see the military dictatorship likelihood that Bereshitsky mentions. I mean, I think, you know,
he doesn't say military dictatorship. He says hard, you know,
well,
hard
except that he links it explicitly to the military reform project. So my case rests, Brian.
Okay, go we're disagreeing again, Mark. I love it.
if one looks at that military doctrine, the new one that's come out, and sorry to sort of shift into military wonkery for a moment, but hey.
I'm always happy when you shift into military wonkery because I learned something.
It changes almost nothing. Mm-hmm. It's purely really about the optics, about how it's presented. Mm-hmm. And although obviously optics matter, we shouldn't believe that this doctrine in any way kind of paves the way for some new militarization of politics or whatever. I think this is the thing that strikes me is that, you know, in theory could Putin turn around tomorrow and say, actually, I've decided to, you know, bring back Kudrin. We're going to break up Rosneft or whatever. In theory, of course, absolutely. In practice, no. And I think this is where, again, to bring it back, you're saying, well, there's nothing one can do about this crisis. I mean, I actually would disagree. Yeah, of course, the real time to have done it would have been in the noughts when the money was plentiful and the chance to diversify the economy and everything else was there. Fine. Okay, granted, that opportunity was squandered. But even if you look now, Sean's absolutely right, in my opinion, about the importance of legitimacy, of at least being seen to do something and not having, for example, this, you know, ludicrous flip-flops we had around Nabiullina and sort of the whole business of what to do about the ruble. Mm-hmm. But it's also, okay, many ways the measure of a government is what kind of decisions it takes in hard times. And we've already seen, for example, this 10% cut across the board for most ministries, but not for the defense ministry, not for the security apparatus. Now, okay, even if you cut the FSB's budget by 10%, that wouldn't give you the sort of money to make any kind of dramatic shift. But it says something about your priorities. Cutting the defense budget, particularly procurement, would actually say something rather more dramatic. The point is that decisions are being made, decisions that could have an impact. Yeah, of course, they can't roll things back. But just simply, if I'm going to think, well, do I want tanks or do I want hospitals? That's a pretty fundamental philosophical decision that a government must make. And at the moment, it's making it.
The Kremlin's always made one decision when it's between those two things, which guns and butter is basically what you're arguing.
Which, again, says there's no real. I mean, at the moment, that is exactly the kind of decision which would suggest if there was a sort of a potential reinvention of Putin in the wings. Yeah. That's the kind of way it would be signaled. So I think what we're really seeing is Putin saying, I'm going to be at least as Putin, if not even more Putinic. Than ever before.
Putinic. And I agree. I mean, in terms of the empirical evidence, I mean, when we were going to see a signal was going to likely be either Putin's address to the joint session of parliament or his end of year presser. And we saw, not only did we not see it, we saw the opposite in those two events. In terms of modernization, I mean, in terms of diversifying the economy, I mean, I've said this over and over and over again. There's a fundamental paradox here. It's just fundamental. And I don't see how they get around it. It's that, you know, if they diversify the economy, it's going to diversify politics ultimately. It's going to, and that's intolerable. The politics
and it requires rule of law.
It requires rule of law. All of these things are intolerable to this regime. I don't think they're intolerable to Russia writ large under any regime, but this regime in this form cannot tolerate that. And so I think there any reinvention of Putin is going to be cosmetic, and it's not going to address the fundamentals of this economic crisis, which
there is a third way, which sounds veritably Tony Blairish. I do not in the slightest mean that. No, I mean, it is, and again, it's something that we've been raised in past months, is there is the kind of the Andropovian model. Mm. Which is to say, look, yes, of course, we're not going to be liberalizing, but on the other hand, we cannot happily accept the kind of inefficiency and corruption that it is within the system. Now, again, it's hard to see Putin being willing to or even being able to do that by this stage, because he is so deeply in bed with these corrupt interests. It really would mean fighting a war with his own elite. But the point is, it is a possibility. And I think the reason I raise it is not because I think Putin's going to adopt this now. I think, again, that window opened a crack and then closed. It's that when we start thinking about, well, where may Russia go, we shouldn't be thinking of this as just some kind of binary, business as usual or happy democratic modernizing transformation. There is the third way, which actually could be a more economically...
The authoritarian modernization.
The authoritarian modernization, but also, I mean, ironically, this would also tap into... I mean, this would also be a rule of law modernization, just not our rule of law necessarily.
Right, a dictatorship of law, to borrow a phrase from early in this Putin presidency. Sean, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's an intriguing idea that they could revert back to this kind of authoritarian modernization. But I think what Mark pointed out, it would mean a kind of war with his own elite, and that would certainly destabilize the political situation to some extent, at least behind the scenes. But it would also require to take this path, it would also require Putin to open things up a bit and take in a new constituency within his coalition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He would have to kind of move away from this more populist kind of nationalist rhetoric to include kind of small business, the middle classes in the provinces and in the cities, not the intellectual class so much, but those people who are trying to establish some sort of small business. And he did make some overtures to small businesses in his press conference, but it's wait to see if this actually happens, especially if they don't have the actual rule of law to carry through these policies.
Well, yeah, and this authoritarian modernization, in addition to Andropov, the word that always comes up is China, the Chinese variant, as the Russians. But what they miss here on this is that, first of all, China is the world's factory. They're making a lot of things that are in my pocket right now and on my desk. Russia's not making anything. Russia's economy is completely commodities dependent. That's number one. But the other thing is political. That's the economic side of it. The political side of it is that China has created this. It's almost an ingenious way to keep the current elite in power. They have this regular rotation every 5 years. The president's in for 5 years and then out. And that would be a way to recruit new cadres. But again, I don't see these people doing this. It's a process they could easily lose control of.
There is, of course, a Saudi variant.
The Saudi, you mean the House of Putin?
not necessarily, as it were, a genetic house. No, I mean, I'm saying that actually we shouldn't assume that authoritarianisms need to be manufacturing economies. Actually, stable authoritarian regimes are purely extractive.
Yeah, but the Saudis are able the Saudi economy is able to handle lower oil prices because they have such a diversity of customers. That's certainly a possibility. One thing I wanted to touch on here, and Mark, you mentioned it in your initial remarks, is the idea of the social contract. Because this is something you correctly point out that I harp on my blog and on this podcast a lot. I do think social contracts are important in understanding how societies work. And as we all know, when Putin came to power in 2000, he offered the Russian people an implicit social contract. You give up your freedom, I give you prosperity and stability. And he delivered. And the people liked that. Now he's asking people to trade that prosperity for empire. And does this work as a social contract, in your opinion? Can will this fly?
I mean, I would say, well, firstly, you know, the short answer is no. The additional gloss is, I mean, actually, if we look at the initial social contract from Putin, I mean, it's nice to kind of summarize it as freedom for prosperity. But actually, Putin didn't really require people to give up their freedoms.
Political freedoms.
Well, I mean, it was actually the earlier Putin era was a period of actually quite a lot of opportunities. And I'm not just talking economically, but also sort of socially and small scale politically. Absolutely, you could not mess with the Kremlin. I mean, in a way, but we have to see it wasn't just simply a case of, you know, there will be this totalitarian regime. But on the other hand, there will be sausages and fridge freezers and Ford motor cars and Renaults. It was actually just simply a look. Actually, you know, you can live normal lives. I mean, I think that's mm-hmm. really, I think, the key thing. It's a normal life, as Russians would regard it, in return for precisely making sure that you do not mess with the political regime or bad things happen. I think what we're seeing now is not only that the prospects of a normal life are increasingly under pressure. Certainly just my experiences in Moscow, there's lots of goodness in the shops. We shouldn't think that there's nothing there. But, of course, it's the prices that are going mm-hmm. up. But it's not just that. It's actually that now we are finding, as it were, the taboo, again, to use the zona. Mm-hmm. The zone is expanding, and I use that deliberately, thinking of sort of prison camp sort of parallel. That actually more and more areas are becoming off limits. That more and more of the media is under pressure. You know, the very fact you're having to have people sort of shift to other countries in order to simply try to avoid media restrictions. The scope for a social organization mm-hmm. in a way that is not. It's not just simply that you cannot be opposed to the Kremlin. it's increasingly you cannot not be supportive of the Kremlin, right, which is going to shift. So I think that, I mean, in a way, I think it's sort of the social contract is also being affected in those ways. Well, it's not, it's you're actually now being asked to give up your normal life in return for an increasingly
vaporware empire. Rephrase that. I mean, trading a measure of political freedom for stability and prosperity, and now you're actually asked to give an even greater measure for political freedom and that prosperity and normal life in exchange for this feeling that you live in an empire. You don't see that flying? Or go ahead, Sean.
No, I actually wouldn't put it in terms of empire. I would put it in terms of patriotism, because this is the more of the rhetoric is that we are a kind of besieged fortress. There was an interesting op-ed in Vietnamese that's still up because of the holidays that kind of said that argued that the social contract has changed to different elements now. It's changed to Russia is surrounded by enemies. There's no social reform. Essentially, this has shifted, and I think what the government's going to try to do is use patriotism to get the population to kind of wade through this time and say that there's, you know, after 2 years we'll come out of this and the days of prosperity and economic stability and opportunity will return. But right now we're in a difficult position, and we need to all come together and believe in Russia, and i.e. believe in Putin, that we can get out of this mess.
So we're back to the bright shining future then, if I could follow the logic of that.
I mean, I don't think they're going to play the bright shining future too brightly. They're just going to say the corner will turn at some point, but we just have to get through this now. We need to go through hard times, and we need to pull ourselves, kind of tighten our belts and wade through it. And as a result, you know, I wonder if Russians are going to – how much they're going to buy this, because I always wonder how much they're actually – if the binary is a economic prosperity versus freedom, I wonder how much Russians are actually interested in freedom in a larger sense, because according to polls, there was a recent poll by the Levada Center that said that Russians overwhelmingly prefer stability over, say, human rights or anything, and always have. So as long as they say, okay, things are unstable, but it's a temporary instability, I wonder if Russians can just kind of push through it. The regular elements of the population, I think Putin has, you know, pretty much given up on the middle intelligentsia in the cities. He's not interested in them.
Well, this leads to another related issue I wanted to discuss, and this is something we actually have interesting debates here in the newsroom about this. Is this generation of Russians truly different? The old stereotype is they'll eat grass for the motherland. Will this generation of Russians be willing to suffer for the motherland, or are they any different than their forefathers? What do you think? I'm not.
Have Russians ever been that different from the rest of humanity?
No, not from their forefathers.
No. But the idea that Russia's forefathers were somehow different from everyone.
More willing to suffer.
I think we have to realize. I mean, this is all really based on the whole kind of mythologized Great Patriotic War notion. And again, I mean, it's always difficult talking about this. One doesn't want to, in any way, undermine the genuine heroism and the genuine struggle. But you remember, you know, if you're talking about the Great Patriotic War, Russians were fighting a war of ethnic survival. It wasn't just for their state. It was actually against a regime that basically felt that if they had any role at all, it was as illiterate slave workers on latifundia run by Aryans. You know, even the most extreme rhetoric today, I don't think it's going to be able to convince Russians that that is actually what they currently face. That the U.S. State Department has that plan in a bottom drawer anywhere. Second point is that there the sort of threat was immediate and gross. It was you must dig a trench now, rather than you must put up with a certain amount of sort of lack of opportunity for an indefinite period of time. It's much less heroic, the current sort of threat. Third point is, look, people were heroic in Soviet times often because they had no choice. Because basically it was that or the secret police would put you in a punishment battalion, send you to a camp, or put a bullet in the back of your head. An absolutely integral part of the resistance that was applied during World War II was because it had the Stalinist murder machine behind it. And the final point is very, very different people. the workers, the farmers, the partisans of the Great Patriotic War were essentially peasants who had been through an incredible whirlwind of misery and hardship through collectivization, but even before that had lived exceedingly tough lives. You know, one has to look at where they calibrated their expectations. Today's Russians have a very different calibration of expectation. But even if we look back at the peasants, I mean, times when they had opportunities to express themselves, for example, after the Great Emancipations, actually they expressed themselves, whether it was in terms of riot or whether it was in terms of taking their neighbors to court or whether it's in terms of other, you know, ways of demonstrating that they had this capacity to think the world could be a better place. I mean, this is why I find it incredibly dangerous, this notion that somehow Russians precisely are genetically predisposed to misery.
I wouldn't say genetically predisposed.
I'm not saying you're saying this. I'm just saying, there is this meme Russians somehow coping.
We've all lived in Russia for extended periods. And one of the things that hit me, and I think hits most Westerners, is that Russians tend to have a larger capacity for hardship than we Westerners have.
Have options. I'm not convinced that if one looked at Britain during the time of the Industrial Revolution, when one looks at the extraordinary hardships of the workers in these rapidly expanding, miserable, stinking cities, one would think, good Lord, these English people can put up with a lot. Whereas nowadays one would think, what a complaining bunch. I think it's just a combination of capacity to express, but also expectation. And I think this is it. Russians have been through a series of experiences of late which have demonstrated that there is such a thing as the capacity to express unhappiness with situations. They know what things are like. I mean, you know, the worker in, 1930s or indeed 1950s or 1970s Soviet Union was being told that, yes, times are hard for you, but they're starving in the streets of Manchester. Mm-hmm. As far as they were concerned, they didn't have a benchmark. Nowadays, even on state-controlled media, you can see Western films and soap operas. You can see different forms of life, and there's no way they're going to be able to roll that back.
Mm-hmm. Sean, what are your thoughts on this?
If you're speaking about the younger generation, the younger generation isn't a monolithic thing. There are elements of the younger generation that are quite, they're educated, they're living in urban centers, they're in various tech and media.
And their standard of living is going to go down.
Yeah, but there's also much more millions of young people living in the provinces and already kind of eking a kind of daily life that isn't that glamorous in the first place. Mm-hmm. Now, chances are that once the economy goes down further and it starts impacting people in their daily lives, the question is, well, what kind of exit will there be for these people? Will they just kind of deal with it as most people around the world do during economic crisis? They just deal with it. They deal with it in their families. They deal with it in their communities. Or are they going to somehow organize some sort of political pressure? Like we saw a few weeks ago with the doctors' protests in Moscow, is there going to be the big danger from the population for Putin is if the people who are tied to the state begin to revolt?
Yes. Budzhetniki or you mean the elite?
The Budzhetniki. This is the main political pressure from below will come from these people who will start putting pressure on their local officials and by extension perhaps putting pressure on the state for the state to do something, at least to maintain a certain level of lifestyle that's tolerable.
Mm. All right. Well, along these same lines, I read a fascinating editorial in the Christian Science Monitor this week, a very, very insightful editorial that said that basically the battle between Russia and Ukraine is now shifting from the military battle to a battle of governance. And that this is going to be the key story of 2015. I'm not sure if I buy that or not, but I think this issue is becoming increasingly important. And how do you see this playing out? I mean, George Soros just came out with a piece in the New York Review of Books arguing that in addition to punishing Russia, which he called with sanctions, which he calls a necessary evil, you have to do the other side and basically do a massive Marshall Plan. No, he didn't use the word Marshall Plan, but a massive aid package for Ukraine that's gonna turn it into a prosperous European success story. And this is how you win this this fight. Again, Leonid Bershitsky, the self-exiled Russian journalist, had a piece in Bloomberg today saying this is a horrible idea. Ukraine's not ready for this. The money's still going to get lost to corruption. But the larger point is this shifting? Is this Russia-Ukraine story shifting now to a battle of governance? And if so, what does that portend?
I mean, I think I wouldn't say shifting is a slightly sort of problematic word, just simply because we're still going to see the real battle, the battle with bullets, not governance. And in some ways, it becomes very difficult to think, well, how far can Ukraine, even with the best will in the world, effectively reform itself when it is still having to fight this conflict in the East? And in some ways, I think that actually speaks to the wider truth, which is, yes, I mean, what we are seeing, and one of the reasons why Ukraine matters so much to Moscow, it's not because necessarily grand historical traditions, or even that sort of Putin has realized that sort of it's time to follow Samuel Johnson's aphorism, and that sort of patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. But so much that exactly Ukraine is in some ways another Russia, in the sense of it is beset by many of the same administrative pathologies and such like. And if Ukraine can indeed genuinely shift, genuinely transition to a Western-style political model, but also something beginning to sort of approach Western-style quality of life, then it immediately undermines the whole nature of the Putin social contract that says, well, you know, you have to choose. Do you want prosperity or do you want freedom? I'm afraid, as we've seen from the 1990s, you can't have both. Well, if Ukraine can win its struggle for governance, that will be important. But of course, this is going to be a very, very long-term process. I mean, I think this is the issue. If we accept the Soros model, you know, and he's more or less saying the West needs to dump $50 billion on Ukraine. And obviously, you know, multi-billionaires are always very generous with advice as to how other people should spend their billions. But the thing is, where on earth is that $50 billion to come from? I mean, he sort of gives suggestions as to where it can come from. But basically, if it goes to Ukraine, it's not going elsewhere. It's not going to Greece. It's not going to Spain. It's not going to war or whatever other priorities you may have. And one has to ask the question, well, actually, how important is Ukraine to the West? You know,
all agree that it's very important, right?
Well, is it more important than having hospitals that work? Is it more important than ensuring that the euro is solidly buttressed and so forth? I mean, I'm not trying to advocate one way or the other here. I'm not trying to say Ukraine doesn't matter. Ukraine is taking the Barack Obama line that it sort of doesn't matter sort of to our sort of core national interests. But I find it hard to believe that there is the enthusiasm on the West to provide that kind of scale of bailout. But the second thing is, I mean, you talked about the Marshall Plan as the obvious model, even if no one uses its word. Well, we have to realize that the Marshall Plan was, I mean, extraordinarily foresightful. But first of all, the money was there. But secondly, the way it was dispersed was actually incredibly intrusive. Essentially, these countries had to give up, in very specific terms, a massive degree of sovereignty in return for the cash on the nail. It was dispersed down to, on a very local level, by American officials. Seriously, I mean, I think to do that, to ensure that massive amounts are not embezzled, and we've got to face the facts, Ukraine is more corrupt than Russia at the moment. To do that would involve a degree of intrusiveness that would also undermine and undercut the whole notion of Ukrainian sovereignty. So again, unfortunately, there's no neat answers. It would be nice if we had $50 billion that we can use on uplifting Ukraine. That would be lovely. But then again, it would be nice if we also had $50 billion spare dollars that we could use in uplifting elements of the European Union or North America that need developing. It's all about priorities. And I don't, unfortunately, see Ukraine as being that great a priority.
Sean, what are your thoughts on this maybe shifting to a battle of governance?
Yeah.
And on the aid question.
I think on the aid question, I mean, Mark is right. It would, if the West invested something like $50 billion in Ukraine, they would have to own the place. That means own it in a real way in terms of dealing with its governance, dealing with the way it practices law, and it would be a priority for the West for a very long time. I mean, you can't – I mean, Soros, it sounds like he's thinking you could throw $50 billion and essentially buy a Western democratic state. It just doesn't work like that. It has to come through, especially it also, there's a role of the Ukrainians in this and how far they're willing to change their structures and fight corruption and to actually put this money effectively into transforming this state and society. On the battle of governance, I mean, I think right now, as long as the situation in Eastern Ukraine remains destabilized, thereby destabilizing the country as a whole, the advantage is to Russia, because they could point to its population and say, look, this is what happens when you overthrow the government. Destabilization, civil war, atrocities, your whole life is thrown into chaos. So it acts as a very good propaganda tool for the Kremlin to say this is what happens when you have regime change.
Mm. So the key question is if Ukraine can pull off the reforms, aid aside, if Ukraine can pull off the key reforms in a time of war. And this is actually an issue I want to tackle here.
Yeah, and this is why it's in the Kremlin's interest to let this conflict in the East continue to simmer as long as it can, and to destabilize the country as a whole and direct the attention of Kiev towards the East rather than actually changing the status of the government.
So not even to freeze it a la Abkhazia-South Ossetia, but to keep it hot.
In a way, at least keep it warm.
Okay. All right. Well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at the two very different men who are setting themselves up as alternatives to Putin and taking two very different approaches to opposing his regime. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
I'm going to do exactly what I have been doing. I'm going to work. I'm going to continue being involved in my anti-corruption foundation. I'm going to keep building my Progress Party. And I'm going to make political statements whenever I find it necessary. I know that the current regime in Russia is not eternal. Perhaps it has no more than a decade left for it, maybe even much less. Our common efforts will determine what it manages to mess up during this time and what comes after it.
Alexei Navalny made news this week just by buying milk. The anti-corruption blogger, who we heard in the first clip there, an opposition leader, defiantly cut off his monitoring bracelet, posted a photograph of it on his blog, announced in an interview with Dosh TV that he would no longer remain under house arrest, and went out to buy milk. And had a little jab at Putin about the rising price of milk in the process. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who we heard from in the second clip there, was also on our radar this week, thanks to a lengthy feature on him by Julia Yoffe that appeared in The New Yorker. He's busy financing opposition media, preparing to back candidates in the 2016 State Duma election, and has an ally working on a post-Putin constitution. Both Navalny and Khodorkovsky are setting themselves up as alternatives to Putin. But Navalny appears to be betting on the regime falling quickly, while Khodorkovsky seems to be playing a much longer game. Both are imperfect, each has his limitations, but at the same time they seem to be the best prospects for the Russian opposition at the moment. Would you agree, Sean?
In terms of as individual figures is basically all the Russian opposition has at the moment, but this is part of the problem. Mm-hmm. The fact that the opposition is putting its faith in single individuals with their own kind of cults of personality is really the wrong way to go forward. I mean, Russia doesn't need another, leader to really take the reins and needs to build up a strong civil society with civic institutions and a broader movement to kind of change society from within rather than rely on some knight on a white horse to come in and change things for them. So I think and I also wonder, you know, how much these two individuals will really affect inside Russia as a whole. Navalny, though incredibly brave and defiant, and he showed this over the New Year break, will he be able to transform his abilities into a broader movement? And we saw that even though the protest that happened on the 30th, it didn't really come out as expected. It was kind of a dud, even though they didn't have that much time to organize and there was heavy police presence, but it really didn't create the kind of spark that I think was hoping.
No, my thought on that day was, oh, what a difference 17 months makes.
Yeah.
I remember last summer when he was sentenced in the Kirov-Les case, there was mayhem on
right.
the streets of Moscow. This time, 3,000 people showed up. Respectable
mm-hmm.
for an sort of respectable for an impromptu opposition demonstration, but nothing of the sorts of, you know, people climbing up on the Duma and putting Navalny stickers up. So 17 months has changed a lot. Mark, what do you think? Is this the best we got?
Well, I mean, I think yes, for the moment, and I absolutely agree with Sean that that's not a particularly great position to be in. I mean, you got Navalny, and I think it was very striking that, you know, in that sound clip you played before, that he said, I'm going to keep on doing what I've been doing. Because that's exactly the case, and that for me is exactly the problem. That Navalny is not, it seems, making any serious moves, whatever he may say, about institutionalizing. Instead, it's all about the cult of personality. I mean, even the business of cutting off his anklet and so forth, which I confess to me I found actually rather infantile and rather more about a sort of, again, personal statement of his own status as this sort of champion. Well, that's fine because yes, he does have a certain amount of immunity because he is such a sort of a figure. But on the other hand, it does nothing at all for the kind of individual who might want to challenge the state out in the provinces, whom no journalist has heard of, who knows full well that he has absolutely no protection. If he does mess with the state will mess with him badly. So fine, let Navalny enjoy that. But what good is that really doing? I think he seems to be at the moment precisely at this point of just waiting for the regime to fall and thinking that somehow...
And he thinks it's going to happen quickly.
Yeah, but that somehow power will therefore just sort of fall in his lap as a result because he keeps himself bubbling up on the news and the social media. I'm obviously feeling a very jaundiced mode towards him at the moment. Mm. Now, Khodorkovsky, though, is a very interesting different case
yes.
because precisely on the one hand, there is a degree of cult of personality around him, but only a little. But more to the point, I mean, he is actually, you know, and again, it helps if you've got $500 million in the bank, in a position to start to try to institutionalize. But again, the question is, and this is not yet clear, how far what he's trying to do is institutionalize his own support base so that there is the sort of the raw sinews of a Khodorkovsky political machine, if as and when it comes to a political struggle, or how far he's genuinely interested in raising the general level of civil society, that will, of course, also mean lots of voices that are opposed to Khodorkovsky or just going in different
directions.
And
how tolerant will he be of that when it becomes
Yeah, exactly.
Real.
And that we don't know, and that's going to be one of the interesting things. Because, again, we're getting all kinds of sort of weird mixed messages. Again, I think he's enjoying the limelight. I mean, it was fascinating, if slightly disturbing, in his interviews with Julia Yoffe. I mean, he said that the only way to improve things is through violent methods,
mm-hmm.
which sounded positively Leninist. And then he said, oh, but he doesn't think Russia's ready for it. Well, I mean, actually, apart from the fact that that's given Kremlin propagandists a great soundbite to
yeah.
use, I don't see Khodorkovsky as a new Lenin. We're not quite sure really where he lies. I mean, his Open Russia initiative is still in formative moments.
And he's all over the place ideologically. That's the
yeah.
other thing.
But the other thing is, I mean, in a way, Khodorkovsky is in some ways the anti-Navalny. In the sense of Navalny at the moment is all personality and personal identity and no real platform or institution. Khodorkovsky is beginning to build a platform, is beginning to build an institutions, but I find it hard to see him actually having any kind of real status in Russia as a person, or insofar as he does, he's just simply one of those corrupt oligarchs, but the one who fell foul. I think he has a long way to build his own, God help us from using the expression, personal brand in Russia, which is gone, obviously, in part, quite what all this money and this institution building is about. Mm. But precisely, I mean, I think you're absolutely spot on in saying that sort of Navalny is looking short term, whereas Khodorkovsky is building long term.
Yeah, I thought Julia Yoffe's profile of him was fascinating, and it showed him warts and all. And anybody that dealt with Yukos, I did some stories on Yukos in the 90s, and anybody that had to deal with their press office, if Yukos was not happy with something they wrote, certainly that with some of the things that came up in that piece really, really resonated. But I wanted to touch on this short term, long term thing, because this is very interesting. As Khodorkovsky said in the quote we listened to in the beginning, he said, you know, this regime's not eternal. It could last 10 years, and when it could last more, it could last less. But when it falls, we want to be ready. They seem to be playing this very long game, setting themselves up as the heirs to the throne, so to speak, when this regime finally collapses. Is that realistic to do from abroad, which is essentially how he's going to have to do it?
I mean, my problem with this is that they're basing their whole political activity on a narrative that Russia is going, that the system is going to collapse, rather than working inside the system and changing it. They're kind of waiting for this apocalyptic moment for the Putin regime to kind of implode or explode. And if that happens, that things could go different ways, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that it goes in the hands of people like Navalny and Khodorkovsky. It doesn't mean that things will go to democracy. It could go in a different direction. So I think it's a really dangerous game that they're kind of putting the fate of Russia and its people on some sort of cataclysm is a really dangerous way to play politics. And in many cases, is a kind of Leninist kind of disaster.
Well, in their defense, they say, I'm basing a lot of this on reading Julia's piece, but they are trying to build some kind of civil society capacity. But
right.
it's by, as the title of the piece is, remote control. You mm-hmm. know, he's doing it from Switzerland. Mark, you indicated you had some thoughts there.
We ought to distinguish between the two. I mean, Navalny is just still very much just simply sitting there waiting for it. Khodorkovsky, I think, of course, at the moment he's building that kind of a structure. I don't necessarily think that he assumes that it has to be some kind of devastating collapse in a way that I think Navalny has more or less mm-hmm. or is daydreaming in those terms. The thing is, I mean, I think what is clear is that whatever happens in a post-Putin Russia, unless we're talking about real sort of military or Silovik coup, which I don't think is likely, there is going to have to be at least some nod towards democratic institution building and a democratic transfer of power. And I think this is Khodorkovsky's strength. I mean, I think he's, you know, because he's a rich operator, I don't think it will be problematic for him to build allies within the upper elite when people are beginning to think of the post-Putin world. I mean, at the moment, he's entirely toxic. No one could possibly talk to him because to do so would immediately sort of identify you as an enemy of the regime. But things can move very, very quickly at that level when Putin's time is up or it looks as if it's about to be up. So, I mean, I don't think actually building grassroots institutions in any way precludes Khodorkovsky also being able to build those kind of alliances mm-hmm. further down the line. It just, this is not the time to do so. But also, precisely, those can be done quickly. You cannot build grassroots institutions quickly. Mm-hmm. So in this respect, I mean, he's absolutely right in terms of his priorities. You start with that stuff. If nothing else, that begins to give you a dowry with which you can then talk to bigger beasts in the political system as and when. But on the issue of can you do it from abroad, well, I would ask you, I mean, I would say, well, how would things be different apart from the fact that he'd probably be being locked up? But how would things be different if he was in Russia? Mm. Yeah, I mean, I suppose there is that kind of emotional, visceral sense of he's here rather than he's there. But since at the moment he's not trying to build a We Love Khodorkovsky party so much as it were the pre-institutions which in due course might become that. Right. Honestly, I mean, if I was advising him, I would be saying, for God's sake, don't go back. You can do this kind of stuff from abroad. Mm-hmm. It might be that come 5 years' time, that becomes a bit more tricky when you really want to start shifting from the we have institutions and we want our voice to be heard to and we want our voices to be heard saying Khodorkovsky is our guy. Maybe that's when you have to go and do the stump speeches. But at this point, I think to go to Russia, I don't think would really make any difference.
Now, we're talking about these two men here, very both imperfect, both with very different strengths, both very different weaknesses. The obvious question, do you see them hooking up?
No.
No.
I think that's the dream ticket. You know, people say, Navalny, Khodorkovsky, one person's got the financial savvy, one person's got the media smarts, et cetera, et cetera. There's no evidence that either of them play well with others.
Not two enormous egos.
Yeah. and B, I mean, sort of what earthly platform, other than the we hate that Putin, isn't he a nasty so-and-so party? I mean, really, what kind of platform? Yes, they kind of believe in a degree of democratization.
Well, I think they're both so amorphous ideologically. Mm-hmm. That I think that makes them almost compatible. I mean,
because at least if they had a clear ideology, I mean, in a way, there can be times when you think, look, I really hate this other guy, but nonetheless, we believe in the same things, and therefore we'll have to swallow that because we want to build us that we have a certain vision for Russia. Actually, when both of them are so ideologically amorphous, it means they haven't even got that.
Right.
So, I mean, that would be my take, but I don't know what Sean thinks.
Yeah, Sean, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't see them hooking up just for the fact, I mean, Navalny has more at risk, right? I mean, first off, they have his brother, and he is there. He is in Russia, and he has to deal with the daily harassment that comes with, you know, being politically active against the Putin regime. So, you know, even on that, I think it's hard for both of them, it would be both of them to come together because one would be taking far more risks while the other is sitting abroad in Switzerland and kind of throwing his money at Russia and trying to develop institutions. So I just don't think it would be, you know, that compatible of a relationship just based on that.
Well, both of these two will be certainly fascinating to watch in the coming year. Before we wrap up, Mark, you noted when I noted your interview with Vox, which I found pretty interesting. You said they stripped all the nuance out. Well, let's hear some of the nuance because I thought your argument was pretty interesting. You basically saw Russia muddling through this year, and crunch time comes in 2016, right? Give us the nuance, because we're all about nuance here on the Power Vertical podcast.
Well, I mean, okay, let me just pick up on a couple of things again. I mean, I think sort of if we go back to talking about Navalny, I think we have to appreciate the importance. It's not just Navalny as Navalny. And as you can tell, I mean, although I have a lot of respect for much of what he says and what he stands for, though by no means everything. But on the other hand, I can also be terribly critical of Navalny as a person. But I think it's really important that there be figures like Navalny still operating. I mean, if we think back, once upon a time, we were talking about Navalny and this chap, Udaltsov, who represented, as it were, the left alternative.
The left and the right, basically.
Now, I mean, Udaltsov has been completely silenced and marginalized. Oh, yeah. He's not even there. And in some ways, by doing that, they've also managed to, for the moment at least, marginalize the notion of a grassroots left opposition to Putin or whatever. I think that actually just the very existence of a Navalny is important. The interesting thing, though, is if Navalny is not going to start institutionalizing, if Navalny is not going to start sort of trying to build out and build a new generation of Navalnyites, not Navalnyites, not followers, but other figures who are also expressing opposition views. Where are they going to come from? I mean, I think this is why, what is one of the reasons why 2015 is going to be an interesting year, if a troublesome year for the Kremlin, is because, in a way, things become up for grabs again. Are we going to see sort of nationalism emerging as one of the key things? And again, I mean, unfortunately, in the Vox interview, it almost implied that I was saying, all Navalny needs to do is to become a violent racist and everything will work out rightly for him. That is not, you know, health warning, don't try this at home, kids. You know, that is not definitely what I'm advocating.
No, and it was clear in the Vox interview you weren't advocating that.
But I think the thing is that actually is going to be one of the grounds on which we may well see figures and institutions beginning to arise, because when times are hard, often that's when racial tensions increase. Mm. Second issue is going to be actually precisely one of what is that mass the non-metropolitan, non-bourgeois sort of young Russians for whom times are going to be hard, that Sean was talking about, going to cope. And yeah, on the whole, they probably will muddle through the best they can. But some of them are going to have to turn to, I don't know, crime and corruption much more. Fortunately, Russia doesn't yet have an unemployment problem and probably won't. I mean, that's one thing it is spared. But we have the prospect of, as the gap between increasing prices and wages expands, is there going to be labor movement arising?
You're going to have underemployment by virtue of the inflation we're seeing and continue to see.
But also, I mean, are we going to start seeing more pressure on sort of employers to start doing something about wages? That's another area in which actually one could see a new generation of a very different type of opposition leader arising. So, I mean, I think this is the key thing that actually 2015 has with it, 2015 and actually 2016, has with it the potential precisely for the rise of a whole variety of different types of leaders. And from that constellation, we're going to get some sense of which way the Russian zeitgeist is heading, because at the moment it's really hard to know.
Yeah, no, it certainly is, which makes it hard to do this program every week. But you seem to think 2016 is the key year, or at least from reading your Vox interview.
Yeah,
is that a correct?
Absolutely. I mean, I think for me, look, you know, again, this is why I was very skeptical, though I'd be fascinated if it does turn out that February shows some signs of putschishness within the Russian elite. But incidentally, I think that we have to realize, first of all, that things have to get rather worse politically and economically, and obviously economics tends to lead to politics, for Putin, for people to begin to think seriously about turning against him.
You mean the elite?
Exactly, the elite. And that's for me where it's going to come from. Secondly, that we actually have to have a situation in which the country looks that much more dangerous. You know, no one will change if they can avoid it. The reason why the elites will change is because they feel Putin has become dangerous, which means they fear Bund. They fear that actually the country's going to fall apart economically or politically or whatever. They have to be very, very careful, quiet conversations to build the sort of groundswell within the elite for taking on Putin, because basically it will have to be a case where the elite is pretty much united. That's not something that's going to take place quickly. And the final point I'd make is we have Duma elections in 2016. And although clearly the Kremlin is going to stage, manage and massage that to ensure that they win, that's not in question. But nonetheless, how much effort are they going to have to put in? How much money are they going to have to spend? What is the real polling data that the elite will have access to going to say? I think that'll be a really important moment to concentrate the minds of the elite and have them thinking that, look, if we want to be able to run someone else for president in 2018, in replacing Putin, we're going to need to have some kind of a run-up time to build the myth. Because at the moment you have a system in which there is one central poll star and a handful of relatively dim stars that sort of constellate around him. Well, one of the problems for that is that there are no obvious candidates to succeed, so they're going to need some time to sort of build up the reason why this is happening. It can't be a rerun of 1999-2000.
Right.
So I think for all these reasons, for me, end 2016 would be one of the kind of the potential crunch points, unless, of course, something dramatic happens between now and then. You know, Putin has a heart attack or suddenly the sort of the ruble completely tanks.
So you don't see, I mean, you see more of Putin being quietly replaced as the candidate for 2018 rather than, a dramatic palace coup or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it will be pretty dramatic, but exactly dramatic behind the scenes. But precisely, I mean, I don't see tanks in Red Square. I don't see suddenly a sort of an announcement to the tune of Swan Lake that there is an emergency committee in power or anything like that.
Right. So you see, so the real change happens in 2018 then?
I think so. I think so. At the moment. I mean, again.
Yeah, no way. I know.
Moving into
meta speculation here. Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up because that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Glad to be here.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.